Okay, thank you. Pleasure to be invited here and honored to be the kickoff speaker. So here's the title and that information. And so again, this is the kickoff off for the program, and this will have three areas. Arithmetic geometry, so I'll say a little more about that soon. Hyperbolic geometry, which doesn't really have to do much with Lobachevsky space or anything like that. It has to do with holomorphic functions or Nevin-Lena theory. And the third one is Arakelov theory, which unfortunately I didn't have time to squeeze into this talk. But it sort of does interact with both of those other two areas. So, I forgot to hit this button. Okay, so let's look at, this will be a very basic introduction, but I'll try to make it quick. So a Diophantine equation is a system of polynomial equations with coefficients in Q or Z, or more generally, algebraic coefficients or so on. And the solutions are assumed to lie, again, in the field of algebraic numbers or in some given subring of that. So let's look at some examples. X cubed plus Y cubed equals 1, that's sort of related to Fermat. Solutions are only the trivial ones. This next one is, 4 cubed. That should be 4Y cubed. 3X cubed plus 4Y cubed equals 5. Didn't take long to hit my first typo. And that has no solutions in the rational numbers, especially in the form that I wrote it down. And this example here is an example out of Hartshorne's book. It's an elliptic curve with positive Mordell Weil rank. So if you ask this question, you get a rather messy answer. So let's ask a different question. Even though the equations are all very similar, they're all cubics in two variables, and all will give you a Riemann surface of genus 1 minus 1 or 2 or 3 points if you graph them in C2, allowing the variables to be complex numbers. But in each case, there is a number field, which I define here, for which the equation has infinitely many solutions with x, y in the number field. So if you rephrase the question, given a system of polynomials in n variables with coefficients in q bar, assume that the graph is a compact connected Riemann surface minus finitely many points, does there exist a number field over which this system has infinitely many solutions? And the answer is very simple now. Genus 0 or 1, the answer is yes. Genus 0 because, well, it's P1, or isomorphic to P1 if you go to a large enough number field. Genus 1, well, it's elliptic curve, so it can be written as C modulo a lattice, and then you have, you can't do that in number field case. Over number fields, you go up to a large enough number field so that you have a rational point, and go up to a large enough a still larger number field, then you have two rational points are independent in the Picard group, and then your Mordell Weil group is infinite. And then for genus larger and equal to 2, you have no, and that's the Mordell conjecture. So now there's something that corresponds to that in Nevin-Lena theory, or for working with holomorphic functions. Let X be a compact connected Riemann surface. Does there exist a non-constant holomorphic function from the complex numbers to X? And you have the same answer as down there, except that there's a different name there. Let me move the cursor out of the way. So genus 0, it's the Riemann sphere, and you have lots of solutions. Genus 1 is a donut. That's what I was saying earlier about the universal covering space. So it's one whole donut at C modulo a lattice, and you just take that function. And greater than equal to 2, the answer is no by a theorem of Picard. So you have the same set of answers to these two two initially unrelated questions. Now you may be wondering, well, what about these points at infinity that I left out? And you can address those by looking, by working with integers, and of course Diophantus also knew about integers. So let's go back to a number field. Let OK be the integral closure of the rational integers in K, and it's called the ring of integers of K. And so these integers are irrational. Number theorists refer to Z as the ring of rational integers because we have these other integers. And you can ask the same question. Given a system of polynomial equations, assume that it gives you a compact connected Riemann surface minus a certain number of points. Does there exist a number field K such that the system has infinitely many solutions in this notion of integers that you have? Well, the answer is not so good. X squared plus y squared equals 1. You look at that equation, yes, because, oops, what am I doing? I'm looking at integers. Oh, I should have used Pell's equation there. Okay, so x squared minus 2y squared equals 1. Yes, with the number field. Yes, with the rationals. And I could make it 9x squared minus 18y squared equals 1. And then that there the answer would be no because, well, everything on the left-hand side is divisible by 3 or some prime lying over 3. So it lies in some prime ideal in O sub k lying over 3. And everything on the right-hand side does not lie in such prime ideal. So so here we need to fix things up a bit. And what we do is we allow finitely many primes in the denominator. So that'll help us with that problem. So for a finite set S of prime numbers, let's invert them in, let's adjoin them, their inverses to Z. So we get this subring of the rational numbers where the set of rational numbers that can be written as a fraction whose denominator involves only primes in S, and let OKS, well, there, OKS denote the integral closure of Z brackets 1 over S in K. So then you can ask the question for O sub KS, and what you get is, okay. So you ask the question like that. So same question up to a certain point. Does there exist a number field K and a set S, finite set of primes as above, meaning over here, such that this system has infinitely many solutions in OK of S to, OK S to the N? And you get this table of answers. Genus 0 up to 2. Pell's equation is S equals 2. Just A1 would be S equals 1. And the answer there is yes. Genus 0 with greater than 2 asymptotes would be no. That's due to Ziegel. Genus 1, elliptic curve, well, you're looking at affine things, so S equals 0 can't occur, so the answer might as well be yes, but I'll get back to this in a second. Genus 1, positive, which for affine curves is always the case. The answer is no, again, due to Ziegel. Genus squared equals 2. Well, there are only finitely many rational points, so there can only be finitely many integral points, so no, due to Ziegel and Foltings. S equals 0, basically, if S equals 0, then you just take the projective closure and you look at rational points instead of integral points. And there are reasons for that that are mathematical outside of the fact that you get this the similarity with this question down here. So let's get to this question. Let's ask the same question for holomorphic functions. Have a compact connected Riemann surface. Does there exist a non-constant holomorphic function from C to X whose image omits at least S points? So here the answer, here, well, you have the same table with different names. So the S equals 0 is the same as before. Genus has to be less than or equal to 1. For S positive, you, let's see, so genus 0, you can omit 1 point, just the function z. E to the z omits 2 points, 0 and infinity. And then it's a fairly much deeper theorem of Picard that you can't omit 3 or more points for a non-constant function. Genus 1, You have, again, the universal covering space, but nothing bigger. And I believe this is Picard, but if not, it ought to be. And then genus greater than or equal to 2. That, again, is the same as before. You don't have any without restriction on omitting points, so you don't have any with this additional restriction either. So this table can be summarized fairly easily, concisely as following. If G is a genus, then the answer is yes, if and only if 2G minus 2 plus S is less than or equal to 0. And you may notice that this is the Euler characteristic of the Riemann surface minus S points. So, I didn't quite have time to fix the color, but if you can't read it, it says, what is going on here? So there's, so why do we have the same answers to these questions in these two very different fields? And I don't have a simple answer for that. I guess you could say that whenever you have yes, you have lots of automorphisms, so that's one way of looking at it, but I think that there's more to it than that. So instead of there's no simple answer, so instead of looking for a simple answer, let's look for a complicated answer. So let's go to Niven-Lena theory. So you can generalize the theorem. So you can generalize Picard's theorem by using what's called Niven-Lena theory, and that gives quantitative results that then imply the results of Picard that I mentioned earlier. So we have some definitions. So it's part or most of value distribution theory of holomorphic functions. And let's start with an example. Let's take the function e to the z, which I mentioned earlier. So that's sort of an extreme example for Picard's theorem in that it omits two values, but if it can't omit a third value. So it has no zeros or poles. So as a map, it omits 0 and infinity. And there's three or more values. There we go. So there's x inverse of 2. So a very crude drawing. The inverse, the e to the, so those are the points whose exponential is 2, and there are lots of them. And this drawing gives you an idea of how many there are in a circle of radius r. Roughly, there are proportional to, the number of them is proportional to r. So, and in fact, for any w, non-zero complex number, the exponential inverse looks basically like this picture here, and therefore the number of them inside the closed disk of radius r looks like r over pi plus some bounded function which depends on w. And so that's the basic idea behind which So let's make this following function, the counting function, that'll count those points. So this will count poles. So a pole will give you zero of the reciprocal and ord z plus. So let me back up for a second. Log plus of x is the larger of zero or log x. So you just take log if it's positive or zero if it's negative. And similarly, the superscript here means you take the order of vanishing if it's positive, and you forget about the poles of 1 over f, so you're forgetting about the zeros of f. So this roughly speaking, counts the poles inside the closed, poles in the disk of radius r, weighted by this function, the ratio of the radius over the size, over the size of the z, and we're let's just make things a little simple here by assuming that f of 0, that nothing happens at z equals 0. So that's the counting function. Ooh. And we also have the proximity function. So what happens at 0 and infinity is that e to the z doesn't take on those values, but it has a lot of values that are really close to it. So if the real part of z is large and positive, then you have something close to infinity. And if the real part is large and negative, then you have something close to zero. What we're doing, so we measure that by measuring how close, so here you're measuring how close f is to infinity again on the boundary of the circle of radius r. And here, well, if f is close to a, so here you're measuring how close f is to a. If f is close to a, then f 1 over f minus a is close to infinity, and again, the notation log minus means you just take the negative part and then make it positive. And we make that definition mf infinity r. So that's, so mf, m sub f is the function of a comma r, measures how close f is to a on the boundary of the circle of radius r. And likewise, the counting function here, you're counting poles, which means values that are equal to infinity, and then likewise, you count values when f equals a by looking at 1 over f minus a. Or you look at the order of vanishing of f minus a. So then, if you define so-called the height function, Nevin Lin originally called this the characteristic function, but other mathematicians refer to the characteristic function as a function that's one on a given set and zero on outside the set. So let's call it the height function in comparison with number theory. And let's just define it to be the sum of those two. So that's the proximity and counting function for values in infinity. And then for the function, exponential function, e to the z, for example, then nf is 0, there are no poles, and the proximity function you can compute is roughly r over pi. So then the height is r over pi, and that's close to what we had with roughly speaking with the counting function. This isn't the counting function because we're just we're counting them with weight 1, whereas the counting function counted with weight like this, but it is close, actually. So the theorem, then, is that if you took, I mean, you could put infinity comma r and infinity comma r here, but if you change the implicit infinities here to any other value, you'd get roughly the same height, and that's what this first main theorem says. So that's the first main theorem in Nevin-Lena theory, and that corresponds fairly closely to a theorem in number theory, which I'll get to in a minute. One can think of this as an upper bound on the number of times that f takes the value a. The lower bound for one particular value, of course, is zero, but when we look at several values of a, then we do get a lower bound, and that's the subject of the, of the second main theorem. This, incidentally, comes out of Jensen's formula. I won't say anything more about that. Second main theorem, you look at finitely many points, distinct. Then the proximity function is bounded from above by basically twice the height plus this small value. By the way, if you have a non-constant function, then this height is going to infinity as r goes to infinity. So that gives an upper bound on this proximity function, and therefore you can think of it as a lower bound on the counting function, which I'll get to in a minute. This error term depends only on f and the values, and this notation here, less than or equal to sub exc, means that the inequality holds for all positive real numbers outside a set of finitely vague measures. You basically can't get away from that in nonlinear theory. So then the corollary is that if you have 3 points, then f cannot miss all three of them, because then m sub f would be as big as t sub f, because the counting function would be zero, and therefore, you would have, you could move this over to the left and subtract, and you got t sub f less than or equal to this thing, which grows slower than t sub f. The minimal growth of t sub f is log r, so you would get a contradiction. I said that here. But there is another formulation of the second main theorem. You can think of it as you can apply the first main theorem. So you replace each proximity function with the height minus the counting function and move things to the other side of the equation. And so you get two copies of the counting of the height function, minus two, because it's on the other side now. And so you get this formulation here, which we'll actually be using more often in the rest of the talk. And there are advantages to this. First of all, q minus 2 is the Euler characteristic again. Left-hand side is independent of any metrics, which I haven't mentioned yet, but that comes up. And you can phrase it using truncated counting functions, which I'll get to later in the talk. I'm doing for time. Okay, so that's nonlinear theory in a nutshell. Next is number theory. So let's give a proper introduction to number fields. Let MK be its set of places. So a place is basically an equivalence category of absolute values, equivalence class of non-trivial absolute values on K, and those can be put in one-to-one correspondence with the disjoint union of non-zero prime ideals in the ring of integers. So that sort of generalizes the p-adic absolute value on Z or on Q. The set of real embeddings, disjoint union with the set of real embeddings, and you just pull back the absolute value if you have a real embedding. And the set of unordered pairs of genuinely complex embeddings. So here I'm identifying a complex embedding with its complex conjugate, because those give the same absolute value. So for each such place, we define a norm like this by, this OK over P, that's the index of P in O sub K, that's a finite number, to the minus of the order of vanishing of X. So you write the principal ideal X as a fractional ideal, and you factor it into prime ideals, and then this ord P is the exponent with which P occurs. That happens if you have a finite place coming from one of these non-zero primes, and if X is zero, then you define the norm to be zero. I should have put a subscript V there. If you have a real place, you just take the absolute value of its real embedding. If you have a complex place, you have take the absolute value of its complex embedding, but you square it for reasons that I'll get to in a minute. But that's why I call these norms instead of absolute values, because once you square it, you lose the triangle inequality. So we have a product formula, product of all of the over all of the places of xv equals 1 for all non-zero x in k, and that plays a key role in many Diophantine proofs. So let's see. Set S infinity is a set of Archimedean Euler complex places, so these here. And let's look at a finite set of places of k. So here I'm using the letter s for something slightly different from what I was doing before. S is now a set of places of k instead of a set of places of q. For x in k, we define the proximity function again, m sub s. So s tells us also what k is. For x in k, we define it to be the sum for v in s of log plus of s with value x. And then ms of a is ms of 1 over x minus a, same trick as we did before. So that's the proximity function that measures how close x is to a at the infinite places plus a few finite places that you might want to throw in. Okay, so counting function. So it's the same sum for v not in s, except we can write it this way. The order of vanishing on v of 1 over x times the log. So basically that comes from the definition of the norm of x, which I guess you can see over there. And then the minus sign comes from the fact, is reflected in the fact that you're taking the reciprocal here. Okay, so that's n sub s of infinity and n sub s of a, which we, So I should have written this also using this ord plus notation, but I guess I forgot. And then the height, which actually has traditionally been called the height in number theory, is the sum of the proximity and counting functions, and you can write it over all v and mk like this, which is the log of this product. And this product will also play a role in a minute. So that's the counting function and the height. And then corresponding to the first main theorem, we have that the if you add up, if you take any other point A and K and add up the proximity and counting functions, then you get, that'll be H sub K of 1 over X minus A. And it's a property of heights that this is H, the height of X itself, plus some constant depending only on A in the number field. So that's the standard property of heights. Then a big theorem generalizing the result of Ziegle that I mentioned earlier is what's called Roth's theorem. Let K be a number field. S is a finite set of places of K containing all the Archimedean places. And for each V and S, let's pick an algebraic number. And let's let epsilon be a positive number, then the inequality of whichever is smaller, 1 or x minus alpha v at v. So here we have to, implicitly here, we're fixing an embedding of q bar into the completion, kv bar, in order to get to, for this norm to make sense, that is less than or equal to 1 over the so-called multiplicative height to the 2 plus epsilon. So here we call the multiplicative height, that's just e to the logarithmic height I had before, and that's the product here. That's okay. I won't give the details here, but we can actually require alpha v to be in k, and although it appears to weaken the theorem, it actually doesn't, because the so-called weakened theorem over a larger number field implies this theorem here over the original k. So then you get this inequality here. So again, you can rephrase it. Basically, this is due to the fact that x can only be close to one of these a sub i's at each place v. So you can write the equation like this, and then take minus log on both sides and rearrange the logic. Then we have that you get the proximity function, let's say 2 plus epsilon times the height, plus some constant for almost all x and k. And that looks a lot like the second main theorem of Nevin-Lenna theory. So, what I should do. So we can compare things in number theory with things in Nevin-Lenna theory as follows. So here I've recalled the definition of M sub F and M sub S. So it's kind of similar. Here we're integrating over a set of finite measure, and here we're taking a finite sum. Here we're taking an infinite sum, where we've got these discrete valuations, and here we're taking an infinite sum where we have these discrete valuations and times log of something. And the log of something is more or less going to infinity. So we can see some similarities between these definitions, and here are some of the similarities. F corresponds to an infinite set of points. Your R corresponds to a choice of X. I'll get to that in a minute. Theta corresponds to, you're integrating here over theta. Here you're summing over V and S. And then your value here is at a particular point on the boundary of the circle, it corresponds to the absolute, the norm at a given place in S, and then the order of vanishing of F at a certain point inside the circle corresponds to order of vanishing at a point not in S, which is necessarily non-Archimedean, and then these logs correspond for reasons that, well, they correspond because that's the way things work out. So you can make them correspond very well. So, and let me emphasize here. So one holomorphic function corresponds to an infinite set of rational points. It's tempting, especially if you know about the function field case, to try to compare Nevin-Lenna theory with number theory by passing through function fields, but that's not what I'm doing here. And so one rational point may correspond to the restriction of F to the closed unit disk. So let me go to my second high quality graphic here. There we are. So that's the domain of your function. Points on the boundary correspond to places in S, and points inside correspond to places outside of S. Now, in the title, I sort of made a little reference to the ABC conjecture, and I don't want to disappoint you, so let's talk about the ABC conjecture for a minute. So basically, the overall theme of my talk is that the ABC conjecture is really at the center of a lot of conjectures on Diophantine questions. So let's state it, the Nasser-Easterly ABC conjecture is that for all epsilon greater than zero, there's a constant C with the following property, that all integers ABC satisfying A plus B plus C equals zero and relatively prime must satisfy the inequality max absolute value ABC is less than or equal to C times the product of P to the 1 plus epsilon. One thinks of this as the subject of the sentence, and this is the object of the sentence. So basically that's saying that that A, B, and C can't be made up of too few primes as measured by the log of the prime. So you can't have, for example, the corollary of this would be what used to be called asymptotic Fermat, in the sense that for n large enough, the Fermat conjecture is true because if you had x to the n plus y to the n equals e to the n, you could let a equal x to the n, b equals y to the n, and c equals minus z to the n. Assume them relatively prime. And then this would be much bigger than this. Contradiction. If n is large enough. And so that's that led to the initial appeal of the ABC conjecture, but of course Wiles has sort of diminished that appeal somewhat. But there is something in Nevin-Lindner theory which corresponds to this question. So here you have what's basically the height of the point ABC in P2 along the line given by the sum equals zero. So here's the height, and what is this? So here, in particular, you're throwing away the multiplicity of P. And there's something which occurred very early on in Nevin-Lindner theory, which was the so-called the truncated counting function, where they also throw away the multiplicity. So we define the truncated counting function to be the sum. You just truncate this order of vanishing to one. If I wanted to put, you know, another number up here, I'd have another number in place of one here. But in this talk, I won't be doing that. So basically, you recall that the original untruncated counting function, you leave out the min, and you just have the order of vanishing. And the usual thing for the truncated counting function relative to points in the complex numbers. So, so then the second main theorem with truncated counting functions is the following theorem, and this is a theorem in Nevin-Lindner theory, and that says basically the same thing as, well, it's basically the same, oh, I should say that f is a non-constant meromorphic function, then nf, the truncated counting function, is greater than or equal to this same right-hand side. So it's the same thing as I had in the restated second main theorem earlier, except that now I've got this truncation here. And this in Nevin-Lindner theory, has been proved for decades. Now, the corresponding question in number theory, we can do the same thing. We can form the truncated counting function in number theory just by truncating the order of vanishing. This is, again, a discrete valuation, so you truncate by one. Same trick for a in k, and equal to x, of course. Here, as usual, p is the place, prime ideal of k corresponding to a place V and S. And then we have this conjecture here. It's unfortunately not a theorem. Let K be a number field, S as usual, A1 through AQ be elements of K union infinity, F sum greater than zero, and a real number. Then this inequality, which roughly looks like, yes, that inequality, except for the error terms, holds for all but finitely many x in the number field. And as a special case, when k is q, s is just the prime at infinity, you're looking at 3 points, and those 3 points are 0, 1, and infinity, this basically is the ABC conjecture. So it would be nice, so that gives some support to the ABC conjecture, and of course it would be nice if we could actually prove it, but so far nobody's done that just yet. But before I go on, let's see, how am I doing for time? Let's do this. So let's make things geometrical. So you can think of a finite set of things on a Riemann surface or on an algebraic curve as a divisor. So remember, a divisor on an algebraic curve is a formal finite sum of points on the curve with integer coefficients And in this case, it's reduced since the points are distinct, no multiple points, and it's also effective since the points, since you're just by construction, you're not coming up with any negative coefficients. So if D is such a divisor, then we can phrase the counting, proximity counting and truncated functions in terms of divisors. MF of DR is the sum. You just make it linear in this divisor. So here I've done it for the proximity function in Nevin-Lindner theory, but you can do it for counting function and also for the two types of functions in number theory too. So then the most general thing for Riemann surfaces is the second main theorem with truncated counting functions. So we also need to define the height relative to a line sheaf or an invertible sheaf. I don't have time to do that, so I won't. But you get the same sort of inequality as we had before, except that K parenthesis D, that's K tensor O of D. The degree of that is 2G minus 2 plus the degree of D. And that corresponds to Q minus 2 earlier, because for P1, the canonical divisor has degree minus 2. So that gives you that theorem, and then with this conjecture, you have K and S as usual. This is again a conjecture because it would imply the, well, it generalizes this conjecture. X be a smooth projective curve over K, let D be effectively reduced divisor, K is a canonical line sheaf, A is ample, and epsilon greater than zero, then for all but finitely many rational points. The truncated counting function would be greater than or equal to the right-hand side again. Basically the same right-hand side except for error terms a little weaker. And so these two theorems, well, these two statements then imply Picard's theorem and Faltings theorems when the genus is greater than or equal to 2, because you can just take D equals 0. So you get 0 on the left-hand side, positive thing on the right-hand side because the canonical divisor has positive degree, error term is small in each case, and you get a contradiction. So, I guess I'm running low on time. So, let's see. Let me just briefly mention that you can generalize these two statements. You'll get a theorem here and a conjecture here again, using well, we want a statement here for algebraic points. There's something in Nevin-Lindner theory that corresponds if you take a, namely a finite ramified covering. So you take where'd it go? Well, you take a connected Riemann surface and a proper surjective holomorphic map, which generally speaking is ramified. So the diagram looks like this. And so you're replacing the domain with a finite ramified cover, and there's some theory in Nevin-Lindner, there's work in Nevin-Lindner theory in that context, and basically you add this term here, which is basically a counting function for the ramification points of your map pi. And that corresponds to, one hopes, the following thing in number theory. You take the log of the discriminant, which also counts ramification, where ramification now uses the theory of Dedekind rings. And then again, you have a conjecture, which you pay a price by having this discriminant term on the left-hand side, which is generally positive. And we also limit the degree of the number fields that are allowed to vary, simply because that seems to be the way things ought to work. So we've added two things to Diophantine statements that generalize Roth's theorem, Mordell's conjecture, etc. We've added truncated counting functions, which makes it a conjecture. And of course, this is even without the truncated counting functions, once you go up to a larger degree, you're again getting a conjecture. So that's two ways of making things jazzed up, but you can also make things jazzed up by going to higher dimensions. So let's do that. Oops. I want to back up a second here. There. So when the dimension of x is greater than 1, you can also talk about these sorts of statements. But now, in Nevin-Lindner theory, it's, again, a conjecture still. So here you have a smooth complex projective variety, a normal crossings divisor. That means it's worse it's at every point, there are holomorphic local coordinates such that the divisor looks like z1 through zr equals 0. So its worst singularities are transverse crossings, are orthogonal, transverse crossings. Canonical line sheaf again, ample line sheaf again, epsilon. Well, okay, so there are reasons for that, which I won't get into. We're looking at finite coverings again. Then there's a proper Zariski closed subset of X, depending only on certain data, such that you have basically the same statement. So in higher dimensions, it's not necessarily enough to look at just a non-constant curve, because, for example, inside a surface of general type, you can have copies of P1. So you could map to P1, which would then be a non-constant map, but it's not what you're trying to prove. So you have to be a little more restrictive. You have to look at Zariski dense images, or here, I've just said there's a proper Zariski closed subset. You need something like that. And again, in number theory, you have a corresponding conjecture. K and S as usual. X is now is now higher dimensional, the normal crossing divisor. K and A as usual, R as usual, epsilon as usual. Then there's a proper Zariski closed subset, depending only on basically the same data, such that the same inequality as before should hold for all x outside of this proper Zariski closed subset with bounds. So, with the degree of the number field bounded. As I mentioned earlier, I think there are many things that imply the ABC conjecture. This conjecture implies ABC in several ways. First of all, this conjecture you restrict to dim x equals 1, you forget the you remember the truncated counting function, but you forget the fact that you could be working with algebraic points, and you look at x equal p1, then you get the ABC conjecture, as has been noted earlier. Or you could forget the truncated counting functions and just look at curves, but still keep the fact that you're working with algebraic points, and that too implies the ABC conjecture. Or you could look at just truncated counting. You could lose the truncated counting functions, lose the algebraic point part. So you look at just rational points, regular untruncated counting functions, but you let the dimension go to infinity, and that too implies the ABC conjecture. Of course, I should mention that some people believe that these conjectures imply everything because they're false. I don't find their rationale convincing, but I maybe should mention that. So the ABC conjecture is really at the heart of a lot of things that we'd like to prove in this circle of ideas. It seems that if you want to make any progress on this conjecture, then you would have to be addressing ABC-like things, because if you expand it almost in any given direction, you get something that would imply the ABC conjecture. So what's the prognosis on proving the ABC conjecture? I guess I have time for one last bit. So let's make a less sweeping conjecture. This will be less sweeping because, well, as stated, it's sweeping, but you can reduce it down to things that are smaller. But it's less sweeping also because it's based on something in Nevelian theory that's actually proved. So first of all, let me introduce some notation that might be a little different from what you're used to. If E is a vector sheaf, in other words, a sheaf of sections of a vector bundle on a scheme X, then in Grothendieck's terminology, P of E is bold proj of this direct sum of SD. So this, so a point in P of E corresponds to a hyperplane in a fiber of E. So that's a little different maybe from what many differential geometers, for example, are used to, but from an algebraic standpoint, it's more natural. So whenever you see P of E, if you feel more comfortable, you can mentally substitute P of the dual of E. So the theorem in Nevelian theory is something that McQuillan came up with. He called it the tautological inequality because it refers to the tautological bundle O of 1 on P of E. And he also likes a playful name. So let X be a non-singular complex predictive variety, D normal crossings divisor on X, A an ample line sheaf on X, just basically so that you can get an error term. Finite ramified covering as usual, and F, so again we have this situation here. And now if F is non-constant, I guess I should have said that X is positive dimensional. We're not terribly interested in, so F is non-constant, so that implies that dim X has to be positive. Okay, so no problem there. So F prime from B to P of omega X log D, so these are, well, you can mentally substitute T sub X minus log D, so that's differentials adjoining dz over z if z locally defines your divisor. So you can lift. We're assuming that the image of F is not contained in D. I guess I forgot to say that. But then you do have this lifting. And so then you have this tautological bundle O of 1 on P of E, P of omega X log D, and its height is bounded by the counting function, truncated counting function, which you can also ignore the truncation, plus this ramification term. Of course, you could also just work with the domain being C if you wanted to, plus an error term. And so if you make that conjecture, if you turn that into a conjecture in number theory, you end up with the following. K and S as usual, X smooth projective variety, dim X greater than zero, which I have to assume here. Let D be a normal crossings divisor on X. R and A and epsilon as usual. Then for all X algebraic over K with degree less than or equal to R, and I guess I should assume that X is not in the support of D, there is a closed point X prime upstairs lying over X with a similar inequality. And then there's this extra technical condition which I won't describe. Basically what we want to do in this conjecture is a lot of proofs in Nevelian theory use the fact that your function is holomorphic and therefore has a differential. But what corresponds to the derivative in number theory, we don't know. So here's a candidate. So So we define x prime, so the prime refers to the fact that it actually could be a derivative. We basically say that there exists a point upstairs with properties that would make it would make it behave like the derivative. So that's the idea. And of course, I have my own name for it, tautological conjecture, to continue with the McLuhan's playfulness. I guess I'm just about out of time, but so here's something, and with this added condition here, it would imply the ABC conjecture, which of course when x is a curve, this is basically equivalent to what I did earlier. But if you drop the truncated counting functions and you drop the algebraic stuff, so r equals 1, then it still implies the ABC conjecture, provided you have this extra condition here. So I guess I'm out of time. I thank you for your attention, and thank you.